From national news in D.C.
to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol,
this is your Capitol Connection.
And now, bringing the Capitol to you,
here's your host, Nate Graz.
Welcome to Capitol Connection. We are broadcasting today from the Nebraska Family Alliance Studio in Lincoln, where we are working every day to advance family, freedom, and life, and to keep you informed on the biggest news in government, policy, and culture from a biblical perspective. We hope that everyone is staying safe and healthy amidst the ongoing coronavirus crisis. Nebraska Family Alliance has published a COVID-19 resource page on our website where you can find information and resources for churches, nonprofits, small businesses, help for families, educational tools and resources, answers to legal questions, and more. Also included is a downloadable serve and pray guide with prayer points and opportunities to serve. If that is helpful to you, you can find, read, and download all of it for free at NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. There are so many questions out there right now, and I know a lot of people are specifically wondering how these guidelines and restrictions that we're seeing implemented impact religious freedom. Is what we're seeing constitutional? How should churches be responding? What do we make of all of this, and where should we go from here? That's what we're going to talk about today, the tension between government orders and religious liberty. So we're going to answer questions about religious liberty, the coronavirus, and the Constitution, and we'll also share President Trump's Easter message to America and a really interesting and insightful interview between Hugh Hewitt and Arthur Brooks about happiness and America in a time of fear. But first, in thinking about this discussion on the coronavirus, government orders, and religious freedom, I want to start by quoting George Washington, who in his 1789 farewell address said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar structure, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." So in diving in to this conversation and answering questions about religious freedom and how we should think about this issue in a COVID-19 world, first let's start by saying that every individual, family, and church community should seek to follow the Lord's command to love our neighbor as ourselves and follow social distancing guidelines in order to protect our community as well as to seek to control the spread of the coronavirus. And in return, government leaders should trust religious bodies to follow generally applicable guidelines. However, over the Easter weekend, we saw an uptick in government leaders showing extreme distrust for the religious community and threatening harsh criminal penalties for exercising religious freedom. Because the First Amendment is a fundamental right explicitly listed in the Bill of Rights, it gets heightened protection. Any state law or regulation that affects religious practice or belief should be generally applicable, meaning that it must apply to everyone and cannot target religious people specifically as a distinct group. Any regulation or law must be for a specific purpose, like combating a pandemic. And it can't simply be imposed for an unrelated reason. So first, let's look at when do these COVID-19 church orders go too far? Generally speaking, government regulations go too far when they single out religious groups, churches, synagogues, etc., for special treatment or prosecution. This is true during normal circumstances, and it remains true during times of crisis like the current COVID-19 pandemic. Many of the early stay-at-home orders applying to churches did so broadly and were voluntarily, and the vast majority of churches complied willingly. In other states without mandatory orders, churches complied voluntarily for the good of the community. But this past weekend, this mutual trust between government and church seemed to disappear. So here are some really concerning things that have happened recently across the country. In Kansas, after weeks of working with legislative leaders, Democrat Governor Laura Kelly reversed her exemption of churches and issued an executive order singling out churches while exempting 25 other types of groups. Similarly, in New Mexico, the Democrat governor changed her mind about whether churches were trustworthy and ended her exemption for churches from their public health order, subjecting churches to the ban on all gatherings of more than four people. So many churches were unable to produce even online services under these restrictions and canceled services. In Kentucky, again, a Democrat governor threatened to collect the license plate numbers of any who attended churches, even drive-in services, while ignoring other drive-in gatherings such as at restaurants or retail stores. New York City Mayor de Blasio threatened to close churches permanently if they did not comply with his closure order. Some counties in California have even banned drive-in services altogether. This is in light of the fact that in most states, abortion clinics have been allowed to continue operating. And we've seen other very troubling developments as well on the pro-life front, where pro-lifers have been arrested for peacefully praying outside of abortion clinics while maintaining social distancing orders. Police in Greensboro, North Carolina, arrested pro-life sidewalk counselors for allegedly violating a county coronavirus emergency proclamation and stay-at-home order, silencing constitutional free speech activities, even though the participants were following the social distancing guidelines in the county's proclamation. The response from city has now prompted a federal lawsuit by the pro-life groups whose members were arrested. The group is being represented by our friends at Alliance Defending Freedom, who in a statement said the government can't allow some people to walk and talk on sidewalks and then say that these pro-life citizens can't walk and pray there. This was never about public health and safety. It was about the government silencing people because it doesn't like what they have to say. While we support the efforts of authorities to prioritize the public's health and safety, people of faith can't be singled out as the city has done here. If abortion businesses can stay open to perform elective abortions during the pandemic, Christians who abide by the health and safety guidelines should certainly be allowed to pray. Only under rare, extraordinary circumstances can religious freedom be squelched. And in those circumstances, government actions cannot single out religious freedom alone for punitive action. Governors and policy leaders should actively strive to work with the faith community on a number of fronts amidst this crisis. Churches are coming alongside government leaders to battle the coronavirus, provide hope to citizens, and serve their communities and help guide everyone through the crisis. And we must make sure that government leaders come alongside churches so that we can still recognize and maintain our country's moral fabric after the crisis passes. And they cannot be allowed to set dangerous precedents that single out religious freedom for criminal prosecution. We've heard from many churches and faith leaders who have shared concerns about how government restrictions put in place to fight the spread of the coronavirus are impacting religious freedom and what that means for them and their congregations. And the legal experts at Alliance Defending Freedom have provided answers to some common questions. So here's what they have to say in response to a question that a lot of people are asking. Can the government tell churches to limit their size when meeting, or even tell them not to meet at all? Government officials must respect and protect Americans' freedom to live and worship according to their faith. The freedom to exercise our faith is not a second-class right, and religious gatherings should not be treated worse than secular gatherings. It's clear that shutting down church services burdens religious freedom. But the analysis doesn't stop there. The government must show a compelling interest for doing so. Right now, during this extraordinary time, it's conceivable the current situation involving this pandemic qualifies as compelling government interest. The question then is whether the compelling interest is being pursued with what's called the least restrictive means. And that question looks at whether the government restriction is more burdensome than it needs to be to accomplish its objective. In this case, temporary, evenly applied restrictions may satisfy that standard. And that's the key. Temporary, evenly applied restrictions. But if these restrictions are unnecessarily prolonged or strengthened, or if religion is targeted by a government body and treated differently than secular gatherings, then that analysis would change. And we also have a great piece from the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission who published a new article on questions and answers for churches on government restrictions, navigating the tension between church and state during a pandemic. And this is what they say in response to the question, what religious liberty protections do churches have right now, and what unique powers do government officials have during a pandemic? Churches have fundamental constitutional rights to the free exercise of religion and freedom of assembly. Those rights are often augmented by federal or state laws like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. At the same time, these rights are not absolute. Just as freedom of speech doesn't mean you can spread defamatory lies about your neighbor, freedom of religion doesn't mean you can spread a dangerous virus to your neighbor. The government has authority to protect public health, and that authority must be balanced with the right of religious liberty. In practice, that means that the government has a strong argument that it can temporarily limit public gatherings, including religious gatherings, during a dangerous pandemic. As long as the government does so uniformly, not targeting religious gatherings for special enforcement or disfavor, courts are likely to say that the government has remained within its proper bounds. But if the government targets religious gatherings while ignoring similar non-religious gatherings, or if it goes after certain kinds of religious gatherings that pose no threat to public health, such as a drive-in church service where everyone stays in their vehicles, that is a violation of religious liberty. So lastly, what if the government's guidance is unclear or contradictory? Like when a local municipality has stricter policies than state or federal governments, what should churches do then? Churches should try to follow the government guideline that applies to them. If the guidance is unclear, the church can reach out to the relevant officials to seek clarification. Many states and counties have set up special inquiry email accounts for this purpose. In many situations, if churches and local officials are willing to dialogue in good faith, they can find a solution and spare all sides the distraction of a public spat. Even better, they may be able to build cooperative relationships that bear good fruit over the long term. Ultimately, churches should approach religious freedom conflicts the same way they approach COVID-19, not with fear of suffering, but with calm confidence in the goodness of God. Neither a global pandemic nor a local bureaucrat can silence the gospel. The fact is, the world is different today than it was yesterday, but God is the same. And when the dust settles from this crisis, we'll have a tomorrow where God already is. And here in Nebraska, Governor Pete Ricketts has said that Nebraska's plan depends on people exercising personal responsibility and civic duty, and not the heavy hand of government. And I think that's the key. And lastly, I was encouraged by an article that was published in the New York Post, written by U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who talked about this issue and its impact on religious freedom. And Senator Cruz says that social distancing restrictions are fine, petty authoritarianism is not. He goes on to write that this crisis has shown us the character of the American people. We have seen that Americans of all walks of life are ready and willing to make sacrifices for the public good to help stop the spread of the virus. But it has also shown us the character of too many elected officials who are using this crisis to subvert the Bill of Rights and rob us of our freedoms. Stay-at-home orders must not become tools for opportunistic authoritarians. To be constitutional, these orders must be narrowly tailored to restrain only those activities that pose a significant risk to public health. I hope that state and local officials will rectify any destructive, unconstitutional efforts of these mandates. We can and must protect ourselves against disease. We shouldn't have to protect ourselves against tyranny as well. We have found ourselves in challenging and unprecedented times, and there's so much to think about and wrestle with, but there are also still things and good news to talk about and celebrate, including last weekend when President Trump, sitting in the Oval Office, participated in a special Easter blessing and urged Americans to focus on prayer and to grow in personal relationship with God. The president said that as people won't be able to gather with one another as they normally would on Easter, they can use this sacred time to focus on prayer, reflection, and growing in our personal relationship with God. He continued and asked all Americans to pray that God will heal our nation, to bring comfort to those who are grieving, to give strength to the doctors, nurses, and healthcare workers, to restore health to the sick, and to renew the hope in every person who is suffering. And in light of all of the fear and uncertainty in our country right now, for the second half of the program today, I want to play a conversation I heard recently between nationally syndicated radio host Hugh Hewitt and Arthur Brooks about happiness and fear amidst the coronavirus crisis. Several years ago, I had the great privilege of working for Hugh Hewitt on his radio show, and it was one of the best experiences of my life. I learned so much working for Hugh. He has such a brilliant mind, and he's an articulate speaker and important thought leader. And so I listened to his show regularly. And recently, he did this interview with Arthur Brooks, who is a social scientist and best-selling author who served as president of the American Enterprise Institute for nearly a decade. And recently, Arthur joined the faculty of the Harvard Business School. He is also a leading expert on happiness. And he joined Hugh Hewitt on The Hugh Hewitt Show to talk about happiness and fear in the coronavirus crisis. And it's a conversation worth sharing. Here's their dialogue.
Arthur, what I wanted to talk to you about, along with Dennis Prager, and I've taken a stab at it, but you are really an expert on happiness, which also makes you an expert on fear. And am I right about that?
Well, fear is not the opposite of happiness. Fear is the opposite of love. And love is the nuclear fuel of happiness. So you're pretty close. People are very, very fearful right now, and therein lies some of the solutions to our problems.
That's what I want. You have the floor. I knew this would be a gold mine of wisdom. Tell us what to do about fear.
Well, so what's going on right now is that most people are not afraid they're going to get sick. Most people are not afraid they're going to die. They're afraid of the uncertainty. They're afraid of, they know that their stock portfolio is going to come back. They're not so stupid that they're selling their stocks. They know they're not going to retire penniless. The problem is they don't know what's going to happen in the next month, the next 2 months, the next 6 months. And that uncertainty naturally brings fear. If you're suffering from fear, you have to recognize it. And the only solution to that is to surround yourself with love. Love conquers, perfect love drives out fear. That's the first letter of St. John.
And so how do you do that?
Well, that's my column in the Washington Post this weekend, as a matter of fact. And there are a bunch of different ways to do it. And the key thing to keep in mind is that one of the reasons that people suffer when they're in their homes alone or when they're quarantining, or as we now say awkwardly, social distancing, which is a term I hope will kill forever after this is over, that the problem with that is that we're missing a neurotransmitter, a hormone in the brain called oxytocin. This is a neurotransmitter that's intensely pleasurable. It comes about from touch and from eye contact. And what that does is it basically signals to the brain that there is love in your life, and that will drive out your fear of uncertainty, fear of the unknown. But you have to stimulate it manually when you're not getting it naturally. So this is the key thing that we have to keep in mind for Americans right now, who are they're social distancing. In a few days, we'll probably all be sheltering in place, as far as we all know. By national order. I mean, some people think that, at least. And if that's the case, we have to spend more time actually making actual eye contact when we talk. We need to stop using social media and start using Skype and FaceTime to talk to people so we can actually see them in their eyes. And every person in your house needs therapeutically 20 seconds of hugging every 2 hours. This is a prescription from your social scientist friend, Dr. Arthur Brooks.
Now, I you're serious. I want people to understand this is a genuine, actual, physiological prescription.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oxytocin is no joke. Oxytocin is really one of the reasons that people feel that life is worth living. It's the explosion of pleasure that you get when you see an old friend, when you see your child, when you see your child born for the first time, when you see the person with whom you're in love. And it comes from eye contact and touch. And we don't get enough of it when we change our behaviors and become isolated. Therefore, we have to therapeutically look for occasions to get this love. This will make us have a much better time, will be much more comfortable, and most importantly, this is what will eradicate the kind of visceral fear of uncertainty that we're feeling right now.
Now, this really makes me worried about seniors who are widows or widowers. You know, I'm always with the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, whether virtually or together. She's on one coast right now, I'm here, but we talk like 20 times a day. Often on Facebook, I FaceTime my grandkids. Tony Fauci told me I can't go see them, but I talk to them. So I get that. But what about a senior who can't receive visitors and isn't really equipped to use social media?
So that's a much bigger problem. And one side point on that, by the way, I was talking to, you know, Jim Toohey, who ran the faith-based offices for W. He's now running a great nonprofit in D.C. called Aging with Dignity. And he made this point to me yesterday. He said, you know, all the things that people are feeling right now about isolation and loneliness, that's what a lot of seniors feel all the time. We're going to suffer through it for a month. They suffer through it through years. What can we do to alleviate that for them? And most importantly, what can we do about it later for our brothers and sisters who are older and tend to be more isolated? To begin with, the senior centers where people live, relatively isolated, if they're living together, they need not to be isolated from one another. That's the important thing. If they're hunkering down, they should hunker down together. That's important. The second thing is that senior centers and families who have relatively isolated elderly family members need to equip them more with technology right now. It's very important. I mean, I realize that they're relatively uncomfortable with it, but if you can, find a way such that you can see each other face-to-face, even if it's virtually. This will be incredibly important for the quality of life of senior citizens, and by the way, of all the people who are listening to us as well.
Now, Arthur Brooks, I have been preaching a little bit. And so while we have to flatten the curve of the virus spread, I've taken to saying we also have to flatten the cruelty curve and we have to flatten the partisanship curve during this period of time. And I actually have stayed off of Twitter because I found after one day, it's a cesspool of cruelty. It's not good for people who are alone to go there.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, the truth is, it's never good. Even if we don't have a pandemic, even if we're not sheltering in place, stay off social media. The data are in. It's just incontrovertibly true that if you're on Twitter or any social media for more than half an hour a day, the longer you're on it, the lonelier you'll get. It's empty calories. It's like eating French fries and hamburgers when you're hungry. You don't get enough nutrients, so you stay hungry even as you get fatter. Lonely people, they binge on social media and wind up lonelier. The reason that people are so terrible to each other on social media is because they're lonely. This is poison. We need to stay away from it.
Now, I also want to talk generally about the media because people listen to you, Arthur. I think our jobs are to ensure, inform, and encourage. That is not typically media in the age in which we live, but to assure that we'll be here tomorrow and America will be free and the world will survive, to inform how to social distance, your term of not preference, but nevertheless useful, and to encourage to what you just did. You've been very encouraging. What do you think media's job is?
Media's job right now, of course, is to do the things that we're talking about, but also to give people solutions and to encourage them in a way that does not divide them from one from the other. Remember, if this were a war, if this were World War II, and this is a kind of a war, we would be banding together. The greatest time in American unity in my lifetime was right after 9/11, where people were really banding together, where Democrats and Republicans just realized how stupidly little these differences were. The main reason that we're not achieving that as well as we should right now, I believe, is because there's a profit motive. It's sort of the outrage industrial complex in this country, where people are getting famous and rich and getting clicks and followers on the basis of dividing each other. It's a very profitable business. It's absolutely time in media and politics and on social media in particular for people to abandon that and for all the rest of us to rebel. to say, look, you know, no dividers. I'm sorry. You know, you notice that there's it's not a coincidence that suddenly the country is turning away from politicians who are being dividers, who are naturally dividers, who are telling us that we need to hate our neighbors. We don't want that right now. And media can play a big role and actually be at the vanguard of changing American culture, of bending the curve of hatred, as you so appropriately pointed out, toward greater unity as we come out of this crisis.
I really appreciated that conversation and wanted to share it because I think it's so important that we are sharing positive news and encouraging one another, and I hope you gained something from it as well. That's all the time we have for this week. We hope that you will join Nebraska Family Alliance in continuing to pray for everyone impacted by the coronavirus, especially the vulnerable, our government leaders, and medical professionals. Be sure to visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org for more information and resources. Until next time, I'm your host, Nate Groz, Policy Director for the Nebraska Family Alliance, hoping you'll join us again next week. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.